Hello, Catherine. This is another podcast of ours that we got together for. So how are you?
I am good. I'm looking out over the Ilsimir as the sun sets in Stavoren, and everything is beautiful.
Great. I mean, the world around us is maybe beautiful as far as nature goes. The rest I'm not so sure about, but...
Did I ever tell you one of my favorite preachers? I had a co-pastor in Washington, and one day I was particularly devastated and depressed about the ills of the world, you know, where the things going on were so ugly and evil. And she was very worked up for some reason, and she was screaming, and she pointed into the audience. It felt like she was pointing at me, and she said, "Honey, you can have my car. The devil can have my car. The devil can have my house, but he cannot have my joy." So I try to remember.
That's true. So we are going to kind of forget about everything around us for a moment and just talk a little bit about the world as it is seen through the eyes of filmmakers, and specifically the genesis of one of the stories that I have recently written, which is one of the Food for the Soul articles that I have written, is basically a list of documentaries for younger people, for youngsters, teenagers, let's say. And the genesis of that story is that Solari had a subscriber who has suggested that he would love to get a list of documentaries that would be appropriate for teenagers because he has a 17-year-old son who got very, very happy watching a great documentary, kind of like a travel documentary called Silk Road, about the famous route of Marco Polo all the way from Venice to China. And this is a 17-year-old person, so someone who is kind of on the cusp of being adult, but not yet. And the subscriber has suggested, are there other documentaries that you can recommend that would be appropriate for younger people and interesting for younger people? So that was the impetus for the story that I wrote. And then we both realized that this is also maybe a good subject that we can talk about, documentaries for younger people, in that podcast.
Well, it was, I find the best suggestions come from the subscribers. And what was interesting is we did that, and now we've got the whole Solari team excited about how can we do more for young people? Because especially now with, you know, we keep telling you, you can't send your kids to public school anymore. So we're getting a lot of requests from parents who are dealing with curriculum issues and wanting to help their kids learn about the world, but in as positive a way as possible. And I think great documentaries are a wonderful way to do it. So I've always, you know, I always love talking about them.
Well, why don't we then just jump right into the subject of your favorite documentaries and my favorite documentaries. Let's just talk about them a little bit. And then if anybody is interested, they can read about them a little bit in more in the Food for the Soul story. But let's just talk about our favorites.
Okay.
Tell me one of yours, I'll tell you one of mine, and then we'll go through a list of several one of them, get a few laughs, and then we'll see what our list of recommendations is. I just wanted to say that obviously that list is, there's plenty of wonderful documentaries that are very interesting and important, but they might not be, for various reasons, appropriate for younger people. My criterion is always that if this is a movie or a documentary that is playing in the living room and there is, a 10-year-old crossing the room, it should not be something that would cause their parents distress. So in my list, I have avoided anything that is very political or very kind of current affairs or anything that could be scary or inappropriate for younger kids. Even if we are recommending this movie for, let's say, a teenager, the list is kind of limited by having something that is does not have any distressing content for younger viewers. So
right.
It is not the list for the adults. It's the list for youngsters.
So the one I want to, I'm just going to go down in order of their appearance. The first one I wanted to mention was Dark Horse. So Dark Horse is a story of a small, depressed mining community. I think it was in Wales. And the protagonist, is a true story, was a barmaid. She was and of course, she had a lot of customers coming in, everybody depressed and down about what's going on in the economy. And she came up with the idea that they could put together a syndicate. It was kind of like a crowdfunding before crowdfunding happened. And they would all put in a certain amount of pounds, their currency, every month. And they would buy and breed a broodmare and produce a racehorse. And this is a rags to riches story, and I don't want to give the story away. You have to see it. But, you know, I'm always ending the Salieri Report with the expression, don't ask if there's a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. And this is an unbelievably inspiring story of people getting together, putting together a little investment syndicate, and making magical things happen. And what you see in the documentary, because they have to, you know, there are good times and bad times. For it's working, then suddenly it doesn't look like it's going to work, then disaster happens, then they go to work. And it really is a story of, you described it here, as a lot of guts and determination. And it's, I think it's wonderful for young people because it shows them how you can get together with a team of people and make amazing things happen. You know, it's such a great example of that kind of, let's create a vision, let's have a dream, let's work at it consistently, let's turtle through the bad, the tough times, and, you know, you just never know what can happen. It's a, you know, and I love happy endings, and it's got an incredibly happy ending, so.
Well, for me, also, that story, The Dark Horse, is also a there's two great things about it as well. One is because it has actually live, wonderful horses in it. And that's something that we all love to watch, not only the young people, but the young people for sure. And the other thing that for me is also a wonderful class story, because they obviously told, well, come on, horse, you know, racehorse breeding, especially in England, is a sport that is really kind of reserved for either the landed gentry, you know, people who have had the centuries of dealing with horses, or people who are very, very affluent. Otherwise, you just don't do into this kind of activity. It's not like getting together and investing in some new invention or a factory or whatever business venture. It is investing in something that is normally reserved, you know, the know-how, the physical space that is needed for it, the trainers, the context, the entering in, you know, the horses into races. And all this is reserved to the very kind of rarefied world that is not normally available to the people who get together and are investors. It's like, you know, becoming an exclusive wine trader for people who normally, you know, pick strawberries in the fields. It's kind of a wonderful story. I love that.
Well, you know, the funny thing is none of them could have done it on their own, but when they get together and crowdfund and keep at it, it multiplies. You know, it shows you the power of putting together syndicates and what you can do if you just, you know, pull your shekels together. And one of the great scenes I'm sure you loved is when the barmaid and all the bar customers are in the winner's circle and the aristocrats are standing on the outside. It's pretty funny.
I know. I love that story.
Okay, so no, but it's your turn.
Well, I'm obviously always biased towards, you know, fine art and you know, and kind of highbrow culture. So my favorites kind of come a little bit from that area. And one of them is a movie that actually you recommend as well. It's called Tim's Vermeer. And for me, it combines several attractive things. First of all, it talks about one of the greatest old masters or painters in art history ever, called Vermeer, and a lot of people are quite familiar with his paintings. Not that there is that many of them exist in existence. There's only a few dozen that exist or have survived to our times. But the movie itself, the documentary, is about a guy who is an inventor, who is so fascinated by how Vermeer's
paintings are different from the paintings of the previous era, because his paintings are so kind of so vivid and full of light and full of details. And he's fascinated with it, not as an artist, that he's not, but from the point of view of optics and techniques that might have been used by Vermeer to have this unusual effect. So he sets to do something that everybody would just look at him and say, well, you're completely crazy. He just decides to recreate a Vermeer painting, uh-huh. which is a tall order, I would say. He correctly figures out something that art historians and painters have kind of claimed and suspected for a very long time, that Vermeer has used some optical techniques such as camera obscura or lens of various kinds of lens for recreating the details of his paintings. One of his friends, by the way, was one of the very famous opticians of the times, and he clearly had access to high-quality lens that were being invented at the time. So Tim decides to do it, and for that, he literally has to create, first of all, recreate Vermeer's workshop, physical space in which the painting was painted. He goes as far as literally create all the paints that may have been used by grinding, you know, the pigments, grinding lapis lazuli, for example, to obtain the blue. He really wants to recreate everything. Soon the adventure kind of takes him to completely different places. Like he visits with David Hockney, one of the most famous contemporary painters who lives in Britain, who actually wrote a book about several books, but about the fact that there are optical illusions or secrets, if you like, that have been used by painters such as Vermeer in order to achieve the look that they have in paintings. So his adventure takes Tim into various places that he would have never probably even gone to intellectually, if not for the fact that he decides to recreate Vermeer. And then you watch him kind of struggle and sweat and toil trying to do it. For me, it's a wonderful art story, art mystery. It's a wonderful story from the history of art. It is a wonderful story about what makes a painting great or not great. It is a wonderful story of a guy who is challenged intellectually and decides, I'm just going to do it no matter what, even though I'm not a painter, I'm going to create something. There's a success story to it as well. And for anybody who is young and somehow interested in either tinkering, invention, or art, it's a great movie. It's a great story to watch and kind of inspire on various levels.
It's kind of, I don't know if you know the maker movement, but it's kind of a maker movie.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's definitely a maker movie. Yes.
Yeah. And you and I have seen this painting together at the Rijksmuseum.
And it is an incredible painting, as all the Vermeer paintings.
It's absolutely beautiful.
You know, we've known that because even Dürer has a woodcut in which he's showing how an artist is copying or kind of using the optical devices to get the right proportions of a person that he's painting.
Right.
So, you know, optical devices of various kinds have been used by painters for centuries because, you know, this is part of their workshop. They just would not necessarily be disclosing it to the viewers once the painting was completed. But it doesn't mean that for some reason they were either cheating or they were not good as painters. These are two different things. But it is fascinating always to see it's like a reconstruction of history to me, you know, right. like when they try to reconstruct Da Vinci's flying machine, right? You know, you just take whatever document, as Hockney says in the documentary, he says, well, that painting by Vermeer is actually a historical document. That's what you have to work with. You know, this is the proof that it can be done. The question is now how it was done. Use that painting as a clue in solving the mystery. It's a wonderful documentary from my point of view.
It's amazing that Vermeer was able to keep it all secret.
Well, look at someone like Michelangelo, who right. I wrote about this as well in one of the stories, you know, how he spent, he lived for a very long time. So he spent decades painting various things and then systematically destroying any sketches and drawings throughout his life. Very obsessively, because he wanted the people to think that he's just has this God-given genius, that he's just going to stand in front of an empty wall or an empty panel and just going to recreate things from his head.
Right.
You know, kind of Deus Ex Machina. And of course, that's not what happened. You know, he was doing hundreds of sketches of various details before he actually created a painting. So painters have been doing it forever. You know, they would hide their workshop for various reasons, because they didn't want to have their secret stolen, because they wanted people to believe that they are such geniuses,
right.
because they thought that this is something that is going to take away from the beauty of their finished product, whatever the reason is. So more power to them. I mean, you know, an actor does not disclose how many times they have studied the lines and how many right. attempts in front of the mirror they have made before they deliver a famous line, right?
Right. Okay, so my next one, going down in order, is Long Way Round, which is a long series. This is not just a, you know, sort of a two-hour documentary. It's a whole series. And it is the story of two actors, Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman, who get it in their heads that they want to get motorcycles and ride around the world. And we had an intern at Soleri one summer who insisted that I should watch this. And I took a look at the description and I thought, why would I want to watch Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman for 6 hours ride motorcycles around the world? I mean, what could sound less interesting? And so I promised him I would at least watch the first segment. And I got up on a Saturday morning and I started to watch it. And it was so fascinating, I couldn't stop. I mean, I watched all day because I just couldn't stop watching Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman. And what's interesting is they start out with the idea. And you go through with them the process of them telling their family and friends they're going to do this and arranging to get the motorcycles and do all the work to sort of, you know, it's like planning a huge expedition. And because they've got film crews following them around, everything else. And you really do get an amazing feel for, you know, it's the Silk Road going the other way. So it's Europe, they do Siberia, Mongolia, it's just an adventure, and you're never quite sure what's going to happen the next day because, you know, there's some scary things that absolutely happen along the way. Anyway, so it inspires you to want to get out and go and see the world. And I think for a young person, it's a remarkable encouragement to sort of go out and see different worlds, different cultures, different places. And you never know what happens until you go out there and try. Anyway, Long Way Round. It's very long. And they did a second series on where they went across Africa. So they followed up on it. But I think for a teenager, you know, of course, the danger is the next thing you know, they're going to want a BMW motorcycle. And they are beautiful, I must admit.
Yeah, it's it is exactly what you say. It's like you think, why would I watch two guys on a bike? But then it becomes something very seductive and you just watch it. Yes, you're absolutely yeah. right. And actually, you have touched upon something that is something I've been thinking about for quite a while, is that in documentaries for young people, I think one of the very important things is that they should inspire, show the way, meaning various things that happen in the world that the young people would not know about just because they are young and they haven't been alive long enough to have encountered that. And the other one is to inspire them to kind of grab life and experience things. I sometimes meet young people, and we talk about traveling, and they say, well, I have never left my town or I have never left my country. And I'm looking at them and they are 20 or 25 years old. And I'm just thinking, And I usually tell them that, don't wait. You know, now is the time for you to grab the world and experience this as much as you can. And it doesn't take that much money to go on a super economy flight off season to some place and just, you know, backpack through some place and experience this, because you can only do this when you're young, when you do not have the various responsibilities. You don't have mortgage, you don't have a family, you don't have a job, you don't have anything that holds you back. And you can also travel very cheaply, because it's okay for a young person to live in a hostel. It's much harder when you're 60 and try to do the same thing, right?
Right.
So any movie, especially documentary, but any movie that kind of inspires a young person to experience travel or the, you know, experience the world firsthand, for me, it's extremely valuable. What is your next movie?
So this one is wonderful if you're interested in a young person learning the history of the United States. It's a series called Baseball by Ken Burns, very famous documentary maker. And it's a history of baseball in the United States. And it is, first of all, I just have to say, I grew up loving baseball, playing baseball. You know, we had street baseball and then baseball at school. And we would go to baseball games and sit in the bleachers and eat hot dogs and, you know, be thrilled if our team won and devastated for the weekend if they lost. But what Burns does through the prism of baseball is teach you the history of the United States. And you see the history of the United States and our culture and life and way of life. And it's a marvelous crosscut into the history of the United States, as well as learning the history of baseball in the United States. And it's, you know, Burns is wonderful about digging out and getting great stories and great clips. So it comes with many stories of great players and great teams and, you know, but again, he gets in that history of the United States. And so it's just a wonderful way to learn history.
Yeah. I mean, Ken Burns in general is a fantastic filmmaker, but a lot of this, his stuff is kind of, you know, very serious politically or socially serious. So I think it's a great accommodation that you have, because sports is much more accessible than maybe, you know, political events or,
right,
you know, or talking about the American Depression or, period or something. And at the same time, a great way to, yes, to talk about the country as you know, in its history and social development through something else, something that is much more accessible than it's such a sport. So that's your recommendation. I will swing now to something very individual, meaning a documentary that I am describing in my article, if you cannot find it. It's about Itzhak Perlman, a very famous violinist, and it's actually not a documentary per se, because it's a compilation put together by some internet entertainment company, and it's on YouTube. But it's a compilation of various documentaries and documentary footage on Itzhak Perlman to put together a story about who he is and where he comes from. Itzhak Perlman has been a child prodigy in as a violinist, meaning he started very young and he was very quickly very famous because he had this incredible talent that was obvious to everybody. But the documentary actually starts when he's kind of in the prime of his life and giving a master class to students at a conservatory. And immediately you can see that his, you know, his humor, his way of interacting with the audience is just kind of like a brilliant personality that comes through. And then in other pieces of footage, you see how he arrived at where he is in terms of his artistic career. Perlman has been an unfortunate victim of polio when he was a child, which meant that he's disabled. He has troubles walking and performs sitting, for example, because he cannot stand. So you can see that his disability is completely kind of outside of his personality. Yes, he has difficulties walking, but it does not make him a sad person or a person who asks for any accommodations. He's just totally happy and ebullient and very modest and very kind of unaware of his of the effect he may have on people. There's this beautiful scene, a very funny scene in the documentary where a journalist is being taken by Perlman all over Brooklyn, where he's talking about his kind of humble beginnings when, you know, he was living with his parents over a liquor store in Brooklyn and kind of living a not very affluent life. And at some point, journalist is asking, so how is it that you got to Juilliard? How did you get to Juilliard? You know, Juilliard being the most revered American school of music. And Perlman, in his complete innocence, he just answers, oh, well, you know, I took a taxi, you know, from the corner of the street, I just took a taxi. The journalist is asking, what was in your talent that made you able to go into the most prestigious music school? But the guy, for him, he's completely unaware. Of course he had talent, and he just took a taxi to get to Juilliard. Most people take years of studying to get into Juilliard. All he, Perlman, did was to take a taxi. So there are those funny kind of scenes that are coming through. For me, this is a documentary that is showing people what it is to be a great artist, because obviously he performs there and he interacts with students. It shows you that, you know, no matter what obstacles, if you have a very clear talent or ability, you should just pursue, no matter, you know, if there's a disability or he has no money or whatever the obstacle is. And also to show that classical music does not have to be kind of something boring, unpleasant, and only reserved for, you know, very kind of stuffy, boring concerts for old people. There's a lot of sweet and rich things in this documentary. I just think that for anybody who is even remotely interested in music or art, this is an easy hour to spend.
Hmm. Okay, so now I'll take A Man Named Pearl. So A Man Named Pearl to me is one of the most inspiring stories I've ever seen. And it's about a man who lives in a small town in the South, in South Carolina. His name is Pearl Fryer. And he had a job at the local factory, small town. So, you know, everybody's got a job at the factory. And he decided he wanted to take up gardening. And he tried to join the local garden club, who rejected him because he didn't have any, you know, he didn't have any significant resume in gardening. And so he decided, okay, well, I'm going to do it myself, and I'm going to make the best garden in my town. And what he did is he proceeded on a completely self-taught basis to create a topiary garden. And I love topiary. And so he had a reasonably large piece of land, and over decades he would come home from the factory and, you know, sort of have dinner and then go out and work in the garden for a couple of hours. And this went on, and then all weekend for decades. And he built one of the most beautiful gardens you've ever seen. Not only is it all the sculpture and the trees and everything and the bushes just absolutely beautiful, but even when you see it in the documentary, it shimmers, you know, and the way I would describe it is all the angels come and hang out there. And his garden became the single biggest draw of tourists in their town and the biggest generator of economic development. And so not only did he become the number one gardener, the state university ended up, you know, teaching courses and doing also, he became sort of the top gardener in the state and internationally famous for this incredible topiary garden. And the documentary is not just a beautiful story of what one person can do and how they can turn rejection into something that's not only positive for them, but positive for everybody who rejected them. And it shows you, you know, it's funny because a lot of times people will talk to me about economic development and they think of it in some kind of machine way. And they don't understand that letting people exercise their imagination and passion is the basis of creating things that create the real value in the real economy. And this is such a great example in one, you use the right phrase, very heartwarming story. Because this guy is so heartwarming. You will just feel, you know, he just, the love comes pouring out and you just think, well, you know, if he can do it, think of what I could do. Now, let's get going. So to me, it's hugely inspired about a man who lived a truly free and inspired life.
Well, for me, it's one more thing also. For me, it's also about, you know, kind of pursuing your passion. Wayne Dyer, who is used to be a psychologist and a wonderful author of talks and books on self-reliance, he tells a story of him once encountering someone who was quite unhappy, a man who was unhappy because he was, I don't know, in his 40s or 50s, and who worked in some uninteresting desk job. And when he was talking to Wayne, he was always talking about, you know, apples, about growing them and the types of apples and diseases that the apple trees might have and, you know, and the way of hybridizing them and apples. So finally, Wayne says, well, why don't you then just deal with that? You know, why don't you just leave that job and do what you actually love? You're obviously obsessed with apples. And that was kind of an eye-opening thing for that man because he just compartmentalized this, that apples is his hobby or something that he's interested in the off hours, and the job is the job. And Wayne Dyer was trying to tell him, why don't you combine the two and do what you really love? Now, there are obviously economic factors, and that's what in the man named Pearl is obvious. You know, he works for a living, and then he can only deal with his garden after hours. But for me, this is something like this. If you really love something, then at least do it after hours, but do it because This is what feeds your soul. This is what is important to you. The man with the apples, he only talked about apples, but he never did anything with his love of growing apples and being, you know, an orchard gardener or anything. The man named Pearl, yes, he had to work for a living, but he does do something and does, and obviously achieve some huge, great heights in pursuing his love. So for me, that movie is also about, if you love something really, don't only talk about it or think about it, but try to do it as well, no matter how difficult it is. And obviously for that man in a small town, this is a huge struggle, probably financially, to be buying those trees and equipment to create those topiary sculptures. But he's doing it and has been doing it for years. And then finally, there is a kind of like a reward of him being someone who has achieved his dream. And that's what the movie is to me about.
Right. It's beautiful. Well, you know, there's an interaction between if you look at all the living things and spirits in that garden, there's a love between him and all the living things, and you can feel it, you can see it. It's like an energetic dance is happening there, and it's that love what's that expression? I really feel the love. Okay, so my next one, because I had a couple more, was The Endurance. That's my favorite documentary. If you said to me, what is your favorite documentary ever, number one, it would be The Endurance, which is the story of Sir Ernest Shackleton's expedition to the Antarctic. And it went, early on, it went very, very wrong. And if you look at what happened, there were very slim odds that they would survive. And yet Shackleton was an amazing leader and an amazing human being and really as a result of an extraordinary leadership and I would say also divine intelligence, the majority of the crew made it out. And I don't want to give it away. You have to see it. But it's, you described it here on the on Food for the Soul as a tale of survival against all odds. And that's what it is. And again, it's a story of leadership and unbelievably inspiring. And so I always find, and of course, you know, a happy ending. I love those happy endings. But I just think it reminds you of what, of how to face adversity and to be an overcomer. So I love it. And one of the things that was amazing was they were able to preserve many of the photos they took of the expedition and what happened. And they were able to get the photos back. And so you have amazing footage within the documentary.
Which I think would be one of the rarest things, because even successful expeditions, and certainly the unsuccessful ones, have never had any documentary backup, because the 19th century ones, obviously the technology was not there to document anything. This is during the First World War, so obviously the photography exists already, to the point that you can actually carry cameras and take pictures, for example. But also the very fact that the material has survived, or some of it has survived, is an amazing thing.
Right.
And it's definitely a tale of survival and leadership at the same time. So very inspiring, right?
Right. Right. And I should also mention, it's always great when you have a great narrator, and Liam Neeson is the narrator.
Yes, the gravelly voice of Liam Neeson. Always nice to listen to. So the last movie that I wanted to talk about is a classic kind of, you know, the documentary about a place and people doing something. It's called Shenzhen, the Silicon Valley of Hardware. Shenzhen is this special economic zone set up in 1980s in the south of China near Hong Kong. The city that used to be kind of, you know, rice paddies and flatlands to a certain extent, that thanks to the special status has been transformed into one of the five most populated and most technologically advanced cities in China by now. And it, thanks to its status of the special economic zone, it meant that it was very much open to the Western contacts and business activities together with West. That's Shenzhen as such. What the documentary is talking about is the fact that this is the Mecca, or the place to go for any technological support if you work in any kind of technology, of creating anything from 3D printers to drones to computers to carless driving or any other technological inventions. What it means is that if you are, let's say, an inventor, let's say, in the United States, and you have some ideas, you can go to Shenzhen and use the both the software and the hardware that is available there to develop, to move your project from the idea state to the actual prototypes, if not the actual manufacturing. One of the reasons, there's several reasons for it. One of them is obviously the availability of enormous amount of manufacturers who are extremely fast and extremely efficient and extremely experienced. The other thing is that the that is a country and a zone in which is using open source technologies, meaning things are not being secretive, patented, and compartmentalized into very kind of guarded companies that do not share the information. They, just the opposite is happening. Everybody is sharing the ideas and technology with each other. In other words, the business model of development of new ideas and technology in a place like Shenzhen is just the opposite of what is happening in the Silicon Valley, where each company is kind of siloed in complete secrecy and separation from other companies. So to me, this documentary is several things. First of all, if you're a young person, you're probably interested in technology that you use, which is whatever. It's going to be a 3D printer, a software to do animation or the latest cell phone. So the subject itself is kind of something that the young people already live with 24/7 anyway. Secondly, it talks about China, the Chinese culture, the Chinese, the modern China, the China that is obviously not the reality of all the young people living in China, but a lot of them for sure. So there is this component of, you know, learn about a different and very interesting and very important country. The third one is that concept of that you probably can speak to, Catherine, much better than I can, the open source anything versus not open source that right. we can talk about in a second. And the fourth is that this is in a 1 hour documentary that is not even a very kind of highfalutin documentary. It's available on YouTube, so it's something that is available to anybody if they are interested. And talks about the future of invention, technology, any kind of subjects within the technology. You know, the printers or the drones or the computers. You know, all the subjects that obviously are going to be very valid in 21st century. So, if you're a young person, this is here and now about something that people are maybe only aware from the point of view of Western world. You know, the United States, Silicon Valley, or you know, other countries where. Western countries. This is from the point of Asia. So it's a different point of view and information that you normally would get. So for me, this documentary kind of marries a lot of things that are relevant to maybe not so much the older generations, but definitely for the younger generations. But let's just go back to this open source stuff.
Well, the thing I love about this one is you feel what it's like to live in a very high learning metabolism culture. So you've got, and the speed at which Shenzhen got built up, because I lived in Hong Kong in 71, and it's basically mostly grass then. But if you look at the speed at which this culture innovates and adapts, it's an extraordinarily high learning metabolism. And I think there's nothing more fun than to be in a high learning metabolism culture. And there's some good explanations in the film of why they think the, you know, patent everything, control everything model, you know, is just stupid. And so you see part of the debate that is at some of the tensions between right now between China and the United States, but you see it in a much more, you know, bottom up culture version. And so I think it's a wonderful window on some of what's going on in Asia. And one of the things I love about every time I'm in Asia, I feel like I'm in a culture that has a much more open, free learning speed. And, you know, they're excited about a growing and building and doing and learning and innovating. And it's fun. It's fun to be part of it. It's fun to be in it.
I agree. And actually, that leads me to something I just wanted to talk about at the end of our discussion is what a documentary for a younger person should be and isn't. What I mean by that is that, you know, apart from the, you know, nature movies or, you know, or maybe biographies of some people, there is a lot of movies that if I was a young person, and certainly as a parent of a young person, maybe I would like to exist or to, you know, I would like those documentaries to be made and to be available, but they aren't. You know, one of the types of movies that I don't see is showing the world, you know, to people who obviously, when you're young, you don't travel that much, you know, or at least a lot of people do not travel that much because they are still living at home. They don't have the money and they don't have the opportunities to travel. But I don't mean those travelogues, you know, that are put together to, you know, to show you what you could do in Florence if you had, you know, lots of money and you went on a cruise. But something that is more accessible to younger people, you know, how they manage to, you know, backpack, you know, what are the places, how you can organize the trip, you know, things like this. There are huge gaps in education that documentaries could fill to show, for example, people what kind of professions exist.
in some way that is interesting. You know, there's a million professions that people have, but you're not going to choose that profession if you are not aware that it even exists. There's a lot of, you know, behind the scenes professions in, let's say, in the entertainment industry or music industry that is really the young people. If you're 16, 17, and you're supposed to choose what you're going to study at college, you don't know that it even exists. You know, right. You see something that is, let's say, a film director or an actress, but you don't know that there is, you know, 50 technical professions that are wonderful and interesting that unless you have some contact with the film industry, you don't even know that they exist. You know, anything from the electricians to publicists, you know, there's a whole army of people who work on creating works of art. But if you're a 16-year-old in, you know, some small town in middle of Asia or Africa or Europe, you probably are not aware that it even exists. I don't know if documentaries for young people could fill that role, but it just seems to me that there is not enough. I don't know how to say that, but there's not enough
how
interest
to.
In filmmakers to kind of fill the gaps in knowledge or inspiration for the younger people. And obviously documentaries are expensive to put together and there is never any funding for them. So the only the big political or social issues get any budgets, you know, to fund it. But these days we have internet, you know, and cheap cameras. So maybe there is a room for people to make things. I just don't see them on the market.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, you know, I've been expecting YouTube University to kind of fill the gap. So you have a lot of homegrown things like that made for YouTube that haven't quite gotten to the quality you need to package them into curriculum. And the, you know, the more professional documentaries haven't, that's not interesting enough for them to bother. And I think the two are moving towards each other. We just haven't gotten there yet. It wouldn't surprise me because homeschooling continues to grow. And I think it's going to, you know, that trend is going to continue. And so I think the pressure for that kind of curriculum is going to get greater and greater. So I think it's coming. I just don't know when.
Well, but, you know, even if you look at the social subjects, I mean, I have not seen a documentary about, you know, what a horrible, devastating effect would a school loan, you know, college loan, university loan would have on the life of young people who suddenly have, you know, they owe $100,000 or $150,000 at the end of, you know, 4-year college where they studied sociology or something. I mean, there's no way in hell that it.
Well, it's funny. I've been working with Alan Collage, who wrote what I think is the best book and has done the greatest lobbying against the changes, you know, trying to reverse some of the rules on student loans. He and a great documentary maker from I think he's from Albany, have art, you know, they're trying to finish the film and they're trying to find backing for it. And of course, nobody.
Well, yeah, it's not a very popular subject, but what I'm also thinking is that, you know, that when the filmmakers, because, you know, I have seen thousands of documentaries in my entire life, the problem is that a lot of these documentaries are made by the adults for the adults, so to speak. In other words, it's made by a filmmaker who is 45 years old, and when it's finished, the only people who are going to watch it are going to be, you know, 55-year-olds in some festival, right?
Right.
And I'm not talking about that, because that I see every day and hundreds of them, and some of them are fantastic and wonderful, and I vote for some of them and whatever. I understand that this world exists. I'm talking about young people, people who are 15, 16, 17, on the cusp of various decisions, you know, which is absurd because you're asking a 17-year-old person to decide what they're going to do for the rest of their life at the price point of,
so,
you know, $250,000.
Let me ask you something. How much would it cost to get a young person to go out and interview and film and make one of those? So if we were going to say to an 18-year-old, look, we'll fund you to go out and do, you know, 10, 15-minute clips on these 10 professions, and we'll roll them up onto our video server as a curriculum for young people, how much would it cost?
Well, I have a feeling that it will cost quite a lot, and I don't know if the end result would be wonderful. I mean, there are student films that are made about things like this, but they are not very, very good. I've seen them, you know, because I actually see quite a lot of student films. But what I'm thinking about something else, I'm thinking about, you know, let's take the same experienced, wonderful 45-year-old filmmaker who has made, you know, award-winning documentaries, but have them sometimes think about their audience and do something that appeals to a teenager or a very young person, to a millennial or a Z generation kid who needs this information but is never going to get it if it's a documentary that is made, you know, for a completely different, mature, sophisticated audience.
So here's my challenge. So I talked you into being a columnist. So I think it's time I talk you into being a producer.
Yeah. Right. It's so much easier to be a backbench, you know, commentator who is just going to point out the ills of the society rather than change them. But all I'm saying is that, I'm only trying to kind of say that in the idea world, I would like sometimes a filmmaker to think that they need to speak more to the future generations, not the ones that are, you know, generations that are running this life race with them. Mm-hmm. Because once we leave this earth, you know, you're going to have next generations, and they need to be given some tools to deal with the more and more complex and difficult and dangerous world that they are dealing with. When I look at, you know, like, let's say 20-year-olds, today's 20-year-olds, and even within the last 10 years, the complexity and the difficulty that they deal with of various world problems is so much higher. Life is very hard. Now, documentary is not an attractive viewing experience for a young person. And I totally understand that. So obviously, naturally, most of the documentaries, if they ever are going to watch anything, is going to be something like nature or maybe a biography or something like this or whatever. But all I'm saying is that I wish there were more documentary products that have in mind the issues and the problems of the young people, and not only have that in mind, but not only speaking to the older people, but speaking to the younger people, meaning less complex, less talking heads, kind of faster, you know, narration, you know, all these things that are hard to find in documentaries, because I watch a lot of documentaries and they are either boring or kind of, or lots of talking heads, or the issues are too complex to, you know, to understand in half an hour documentary. All those things are very noble attempts, but I don't think they are reaching the audience they should be reaching.
Well, all I'm telling you is I think you should become a producer.
Right now, let's just make a podcast that, you know, someone might listen to and get inspired. That's all I'm trying to do, just get people inspired in looking at things.
Okay, well, we should point out in the subscribers' input, at the Salieri Report, if you have ideas for Food for the Soul as to what Nina can do in her columns and her podcasts to help your kids discover and enjoy art, music, film, let her know. And just post it at subscriber input. We'd love to get your feedback.
Amen to that, yes. Well, Catherine, and we have wasted another perfectly good hour, I would say, on talking about movies we love and things that maybe some people would watch.
You and I never waste time talking about movies. It's always, I don't know. I love good movies, but I really love great documentaries. So it's always a pleasure to talk with you about them, because I cannot believe I've never met anybody who knows as much about movies or documentaries as you. So I feel like I'm always drinking from a well, you know. So I remember once sitting in your living room and I asked you for your, you know, top 100 favorite movies, and you listed off, I don't know, scores and scores of movies. Not only did I not know them, I never even heard of them. I was like, wow, I'm a babe in the woods.
Well, I think that us, all of us being in a lockdown is going to make experts out of all of us, because we basically watch, you know, 12 hours a day instead of, you know, 2 hours a week, because we have no choice, which is why we created this list, you know, for some bored teenagers to watch something different than another superhero movie. Thank you very much. We hope that we have inspired some families to kind of check out documentaries, not just feature films. And till the next one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day, Nina.
You too.